The last one was in, oh, and the meeting is being recorded. The last one was in Windsor in January. And this forum was planned for a while, but we altered it to talk about COVID-19 because that seemed like a very important topic. And I am pleased to welcome back Chris Bush from the University of Windsor. Chris is the Associate Vice President, Enrollment Management at the University of Windsor. He is responsible for orchestrating the institution's enrollment and internationalization strategies. And Chris is the only one of our four panelists who was with us in January. So thank you, Chris, for making the time. Larissa Bezzo is our representative from the Canadian Bureau for International Education. Larissa is the president and chief executive officer of the organization. She has been involved for 15 years in international development and education. And she has also worked with the World Bank and with the International Center for Policy Studies in Ukraine. So she brings a real international experience to her discussion about international students in Canada. Nathaniel Veldkamp is the manager of international recruitment and project development at St. Clair College. He has worked with international students for the past 5 years at St. Clair College, as it has expanded its enrollment of international students exponentially. And Nathaniel also has a great deal of experience with foreign affairs and international development as a special assistant to the Minister of Parliament for Chatham-Kent, MP David Van Kesteren. And finally, but certainly not least, Ankit Tripath. Okay, Ankit, I practiced the first name, but not the second. Ankit Tripathi is the international student representative at the Canadian Federation of Students. He is an international student from India who is in his fourth year at Trent University, where he is majoring in environmental science and business administration. As the international student rep, he works on ways to mobilize international students in Canada's universities and colleges and to demand better treatment, particularly right now in terms of access to health insurance and healthcare. So those are our four speakers. We have a set of six questions. We have identified people to talk about each of the questions, two or three for each question. And we will go through the questions in order. I'm going to ask all of you, wherever you are, to please hold your comments to the end. We're going to hold the speakers to a tight schedule, and I'm a geographer, so I am a time czar of the worst kind. And we would like to open the floor to questions at around 4 o'clock, which will leave about 20 minutes for questions. You can indicate your questions by typing them into the chat box. And Sandhya Shankar, who is, I've lost track of now, is going to moderate the chat box and let me know sort of groupings of questions at the end. Okay. So are there any concerns, comments? And if you really have something important to say, please use the little reaction man. We only want positive comments, please, if possible. But that's the button to use. And mine, of course, is now going to stay. So let me begin. And I want to address this question to Ankit first, and then to Larissa. What are the major challenges, say the top three, that international students have faced during the pandemic? And Ankit, do you want to begin?
No, certainly. Thank you so much for organizing this, first of all. Hi, everybody. My name is Ankit. Last name is Tripathi. I appreciate the attempt. It's okay. No one's been able to say it since I got here. My pronouns are he and him. I'm here with the Canadian Federation of Students. We're the largest and the most representative body of students in Canada, representing over 350,000 students. And this is a question, not only have we been grappling with it, but also trying to recommend ways around the question of international students, because it's been a pretty difficult time. If I were to summarize and give three biggest issues that we faced amongst the myriad during this period, the very first one is the most overarching one, that's consideration. The kind of consideration whether or not international students are considered in policy making, both at the universities, cities, provincially and nationally, has been it's been an afterthought this whole time. Every time international students are considered, it's like, if we've planned for everyone, oh, and international students may or may not have access to XYZ, right? International students just happened to be eligible for something like CERB, where we could apply, but at no point were directly addressed that, yes, you're eligible for this. If you're a migrant worker, or if you're working in Canada who met those eligibility conditions, we made it. But in CESB, we were systematically excluded, right? So consideration in policymaking is the biggest challenge we've been facing, because that would solve most of our issues. The second one is then monetary. Access to funds during this time has been so difficult. International students many of us have packed up and left. The ones who've stayed back here have struggled. Being able to find a job is very hard as it is. Being an international student, many of us are racialized. The degree of xenophobia we see in Canada is not that different from the kind that exists in the United States, as much as we like to say that about Canada and try to feel better. It's really not that different. So trying to be able to find a job and be financially, to sustain ourselves financially is very hard. And the aspect that's often forgotten during a pandemic like COVID-19 is just that it's not a North American thing, it's a global thing. And many of our parents have also lost work. So the argument that, oh, maybe your parents can support you, it just doesn't work. And finally, last but not the least, immigration. Global immigration has changed so fast during this time that I think it would have been great to receive more support from the Canadian government. But it's just not been there, and it's all been international politics, which hasn't actually helped the case of international students during this pandemic. So those, in my opinion, are the top three things that have actually impacted the experience of being an international student in Canada during this pandemic.
Larissa, what does your survey show?
Thanks, Valerie. So CBIE typically every couple of years runs a broad-based international student survey to gain insights in terms of, you know, the reasons why, not only why students choose Canada as a destination for learning, but to really gain insight in terms of their experience, the pathways, you know, their desires, hopes, aspirations, et cetera, and to understand more operationally what that support looks like at an institutional level and nationally. We're scheduled to kind of run that next survey, hopefully within the next 12 months. With the pandemic, we've pushed things out. The surveys that we've been doing in the last number of months have really been at an institutional level to try to understand, you know, the complexities of the different dimensions of internationalization. Our focus is on all aspects of international. So one key element of that, of course, is the students and mobility both in and out of country. And I think, so I can't speak in terms of survey results specifically related to students at this point, but as an organization that administers a host of government scholarship programs, including our own Canadian programs, as well as those of many foreign governments and partners where we have international students in Canada who obviously were very directly impacted by the pandemic, I think there are a lot of important insights. The two or three that I might point to significantly we've seen very profound impact in terms of students' well-being, so both physical and mental well-being, and that has been a cause for concern. And I think, you know, one of the significant messages that I would want to share from what we have experienced, kind of being on the front lines directly in contact with many of those students, is all of our students, whether that be Canadian, you know, domestic students or international students in Canada, have been profoundly impacted by the pandemic, as we all have across Canada. However, what we have noticed as an organization is that impact and those vulnerabilities are much more profound, much deeper when it comes to international students. And I think those vulnerabilities existed prior to the pandemic, but the pandemic has really only shone light on some of those vulnerabilities. And I think it's an important time for us to turn our attention to those issues, but well-being certainly is top of mind. We saw early in this experience, just by virtue of the public health measures that put into place as kind of we were going into lockdown, as there was kind of a moratorium on travel, et cetera, we saw campuses have to pivot, and many institutions stepped up in terms of trying to provide support to students, for them to be able to, for example, remain on campus, et cetera. In some jurisdictions, that simply wasn't possible. So you had students who were forced to relocate, find, you know, appropriate housing in the midst of a very challenging situation, even gaining access to things such as, you know, basic necessities, food, et cetera, in the midst of this. And how that played out jurisdictionally has been really quite different from coast to coast to coast. But also the mental health impacts. I mean, the reality is, in many of the domestic student situations, individuals were perhaps able to return home or to connect with family. Proximity to family for those students physically located in Canada, simply not possible. And given other challenges, resource, infrastructure, et cetera, the connection to family, even virtually, also not as easy and quite disrupted. And so that has been top of mind for us, the dimensions of well-being. I agree with Ankit in terms of the observations around, you know, the policy frameworks and in particular some of the immigration dimensions. There's been a move to, I think, create nimbleness and flexibility in terms of the policy frameworks. You know, we saw some of those early interventions in terms of pivoting to allow learning to happen and even to begin online, you know, particular for those students who are conscious and perhaps intentional about further pathways to, you know, postgraduate employment or pathways to permanent residency. You know, those were certainly seen as important steps, but I think there have been knock-on consequences. You know, one of the conversations that we're seeing bubble up across the country is the whole issue of, with the online learning happening, students, for example, who may not have the possibility to physically return to Canada at the moment, but who are continuing their studies, they're doing that from their homes. Right across the globe, and from a technological standpoint, that's positive. However, that also creates additional risks in terms of learning environments, in terms of, you know, the kind of openness and transparency that we see in our campuses as part of the Canadian experience. That becomes quite complex, you know, when there is that kind of geographical distance. And so we think those vulnerabilities are issues that I would point to, that are certainly top of mind in terms of students' well-being and future intentions.
Larissa, can you, just in case there's anybody here, can you remind us what are the requirements for students to qualify for a postgraduate work permit and for a pathway to permanent residence in terms of presence in Canada?
So, I mean, a lot of that has been loosened up, and I by no means purport to be the expert on this. We have an entire immigration advisory committee that deals with the technicalities of this. But in order to be eligible, let's say in a pre-COVID situation, there were requirements in terms of time actually physically spent studying in Canada. And so that policy framework has been rendered more flexible in order for learners to begin their studies online, and also extended such that up to 50% of their studies can now take place outside of Canada. Okay. And so those are some new, at this point, being described as temporary measures. you know, whether we see that scaled back or adjusted as our experience with the pandemic unfolds, as we see more uptake in terms of the face-to-face learning and the possibilities of entry into Canada expanded. But at this point, those are some new dimensions. And so that eligibility, you know, pre-COVID would need to have been in place in order for an individual to then have their study time count towards a future postgraduate work permit. And it is quite unique as we, when we compare ourselves to other jurisdictions. There are some that allow for that, but that those are some elements from kind of an immigration and pathway perspective that provide, I think, some really significant opportunities in terms of our international students.
Okay, thank you. All right, Nathaniel, Chris, how have universities and colleges tried to meet the needs of international students? And you guys can decide who wants to go first.
I'll let you go first.
Oh, thanks, Nathaniel. Valerie, I think probably the biggest things institutions have done to address this situation is to recognize the unique circumstances that international students are in compared to what I would classify as our domestic students. I think too often, sometimes the ideology of treating all students equally needs to be kind of challenged. And the pandemic definitely has done that, confirming the unique challenges that international students face. In this case, with travel restrictions, individuals coming to the country or being isolated abroad, borders closing, the immigration uncertainty. I think for myself, I look specifically to the push and pull factors that drive students to come to Canada, not only for the quality of education at the institutions, but also that idea of gaining a Canadian experience in the workplace, potentially settling to the country. And the pandemic has turned that upside down, you know, on top of the normal uncertainty that international students face when coming to their a new country. How will I fit in? How will I meet friends? How will I gain that experience? The pandemic has caused that to be ratcheted up even more, throw in financial stressors, et cetera. So, you know, to offset those issues, you know, a lot of institutions, including mine, and I'm sure Nathaniel's as well, kind of, we amended our policies and procedures to become more flexible because we had to recognize the circumstances. It's a dynamic situation that's constantly changing. So therefore, how we approach problems needs to change. That how we progress through processes needs to change too. And on top of that, you know, providing a significant amount of support, not only to deal with the mental and physical well-being issues, but also on the financial piece. You know, the University of Windsor has now contributed $1.2 million towards financial support, but also recognizing the evaporation of the environment in which students would gain experiences outside our classrooms. So trying to stand up new experiential learning opportunities and work placements was really important to us.
Nathaniel.
Yeah, I would agree and echo everything that that Chris touched on. The unique aspect for the college in all of this is traditionally, I mean, we're an applied education institution. So what makes us unique and what is a big draw for our international students is that that hands-on learning environment that we create with the labs and all of the infrastructure here on campus. So it was something that we had to adjust to quickly with moving an applied curriculum to online base. And our faculty were great during that transition. We've tried to approach each case or concern that an international or a student in general brings on a case by case and address it on the go, because as Chris mentioned, a lot of things are changing rapidly every day. So it's thankfully here at St. Clair College, we have a very, we're a lean operation, but we're interconnected in a way that I don't know if you'd find in a lot of other institutions. So if a concern or an issue arises in academics, The international office is able to come alongside and help that department or student services with perhaps a student concern. We can speak into that and give it some context to that. And so, perhaps I would like to say that the college, the internationalization of the campus got thrown into the deep end during all of this. And I think we'll be better for it at coming through it, but it has really required all of us at every position at the college to consider international students and their unique concerns and issues that have arisen during this.
Nathaniel, I'm going to start with you. Can you give me a specific example of how St. Clair College has changed its pedagogy? We all went online. Even I'm learning online. I must say it's hard. But the hands-on, for example, how do you put hands-on?
Well, we did have international students come to us this fall. So we did identify those programs that it just wasn't possible in the mechanical engineering technician programs. So we had to work with Immigration, Refugee and Citizenship Canada. We had to ensure that we were giving up-to-date information to international students who did have to come into Canada and work with them individually on arrival protocol. The quarantine plans once they arrive to Canada. We've had over 500 international students come in the last 4 weeks. We've had to stick handle that, and we've seen a change in just the last few weeks with what the government is requiring DLIs to have in place to support inbound international students. So. That was something that we just weren't able to put online on some of those programs. And as far as those in the business and IT that we are delivering online, it's leveraging a lot of the technologies that our professors, our instructors have, and providing synchronous and asynchronous learning opportunities for our students, looking at when we schedule classes, having professors or technicians available in times where they may traditionally not be in the office, have ability for students in different time zones so that they can dialogue in real time versus on the Teams or Blackboard platforms. That we utilize here at St. Clair. So those are just a few options. Now, I have to admit, I'm an administrator. I'm not a faculty member. So I hope I passed myself in that. But maybe those are two examples for us here at St. Clair.
No, those are really good examples. And all I can say is I've taught online before, but this is the hardest it's ever been. Chris? Some specifics about what you've done at University of Windsor.
Well, just to follow Nathaniel's lead, I think it's about rethinking how we deliver education, given that we can't adopt the same, I'm going to say, historical approach of a sage on the stage. For online education just requires, different pedagogical approach. So at the institution, we stood up a large number of research or teaching assistants to help faculty members primarily learn how to navigate the technology. We have a great Center for Teaching and Learning and Office of Open Learning that have been able to support, faculty there. But, Nathaniel raised a good point. It's about thinking about, is online education just about offering the same class but via Zoom at the exact same time? But if I'm a student learning from India, that's a completely different time zone. What is my, we pride ourselves on being a connected society, but the technology in which students access our institutions, be it the library or virtual machines that they're accessing remotely requires a significant amount of bandwidth, which, you know, here in Windsor Essex, the faculty that reside in the county, they have difficulty sometimes accessing those resources. Could you imagine what the experience is for someone in Nigeria or in India, where the power is not necessarily reliable? And so it does require us to kind of flip upside down what we think of, how do we deliver it and support it in a manner that's more conducive to these times. And as Nathaniel indicated, I actually think at the end of this whole pandemic, us as institutions may be much stronger. I think the delivery model of education may be stronger, and also the knowledge of the challenges international students face is going to become much more prominent.
Chris, I want to follow up on that. How are you figuring out what international students need? Are you surveying them? Are you waiting for complaints or concerns? Or are you sitting in a room with a bunch of people and saying, well, we think this is what international students need? So I'm curious.
I think it's a mixture of maybe all three.
Okay.
Early on in the pandemic, we did a lot of survey outreach, be it webinars, survey instruments, to kind of collect an understanding of how apt international students are to learning online. Because that's also another assumption that we needed to break. A lot of high school students and university students have experienced online education before, maybe not to the magnitude that they are now. But in an international market, they may have no exposure to that. So we did outreach surveys to kind of get an understanding of that, to gain that. And the complaint process is valid. You know, receiving information about how am I supposed to join a synchronous class that's at 3 a.m. Makes us think that, yes, it's probably not a good idea to have a class delivered solely in that pedagogy if you have a diverse group of learners.
Okay. Now, I was just intrigued by this question. Kate, I have a question for you, and also we'll go back to Chris and Nathaniel after that. How do you think that the pandemic has affected international students' post-graduation pathways?
Certainly, that's a very good question. That's a question I'm personally grappling with right now as I'm halfway through my last semester in school. And I have to say there are a few ways, but they fall back into the categories that I mentioned in my main three issues, right? In consideration, immigration, and you know, just monetary health. And I think I also want to touch on something that Larissa said about mental health. I think that's a very, very big one. Our support systems have been taken away from us in many ways, and it's been harder to reconnect. But in specifically with regards to pathways after graduation, I think before we even get to that, the question that administrators and the province and even the country should ask themselves is that, are international students going to be able to finish their education in these circumstances? Mm. In the circumstances where the quality of education, the standards for immigration, and the cost of tuition have been unchanged, but every underlying principle has been almost shattered, where international students are, just like Chris mentioned, studying from different time zones, not maybe within Canada, maybe outside Canada, paying the exact same amount of money, and the government not being proactive enough to tell us as to whether or not, what are the things we can and can't do. My biggest fear going into last semester, I only have one more course to finish. So I'm a part-time student this semester. And the question that went entirely unanswered pretty much all summer was, can part-time students who are international work in this semester? Are international students allowed to take this semester off and just be migrant workers in Canada without the need of changing our work or study status? Right? These are unanswered questions that we're just, at this point, if someone gets deported, we'll figure it out, I guess. That's the state of things, right? And it's not great. So that's one. The ability to finish school is the primary one, because that's when you're certain you're going to finish school is when you're going to look at your post-graduation pathways. And then the ability to sustain ourselves. The employment And the kind of employment that is available for international students is, and for anybody at this point in this economy and in all economies across the world, is not great. It's very hard to find a job and be able to, you know, actually land in one of those immigration criteria, because you're supposed to have a specific job title that will be able to get you the points you need to be able to apply for a permanent residency once you finish your 3-year post-graduation work permit. Right? And that's a major consideration. How am I going to find myself? I mean, how am I going to get a post-graduation work permit and be paying bills doing Uber Eats? That's just not sustainable, right? Especially when Canada, in Stephen Harper's government in 2013, said, we want more international students coming into the country. But the circumstances around it have just not been the same. The other way that international...
Hello? Ankit? Sandhya?
Oh. Hey, Valerie.
Hi, Ankit. You're now back. You were saying the other way.
Yes. Sorry. So the other way that international students sustain ourselves is through summer jobs, right? Like any student in university in Canada. And when the Canada summer job subsidy was announced by the government in March, we were excluded. Every year in the federal summer jobs subsidy, international students are excluded. On all campuses in Ontario, there are work-study programs, work-study positions that we're not eligible for. Then how do you expect us to sustain ourselves and be able to sustain these high costs of tuition and living? Exclusion from funding opportunities. If you're a grad student, you can't apply for SHRC. You can't apply for any provincial or federal funding. So you can figure out how you're going to get your money. But, you know, once you've figured that out, we're happy to have you. I also want to highlight specifically with regards to healthcare. Every international student that has a job pays income taxes. Those income taxes go towards provincial healthcare, but we also pay separately for UHIP or CHIP or wherever you are. So we're essentially paying twice for healthcare and still not getting a very good service. Like, if we're going to look at it from a market-based approach, then we're paying a lot more than what we're getting. And finally, there is, during this pandemic, something I've grappled with, and it's very disturbing. The rise of a very American rhetoric that international students are taking away our jobs. Having been unemployed for as long as I have to say that's the funniest one, but it's very real. And it's found its place at the heart of many, just many discussions with people in the communities that I've been in, and it's heartbreaking, right? Canada wants us here, but the actions are speaking very differently.
So, in this order, Larissa, Chris, and Nathaniel, have you got anything to add to what Ankit said from the perspective of how has the pandemic affected the post-graduation pathways of international students?
Yes, absolutely happy to jump in and just share a few thoughts. I mean, globally, we saw the report that recently came out from the OECD looking at the, you know, impact of COVID on education. And they certainly validate many of the things that you touched on, Ankit. In particular, you know, talking about, you know, the perception, but I mean the very real lived experience of, you know, students seeing and questioning the value of learning abroad for their degrees, and the concerns about, you know, missing out on exposure, missing out on inputs into kind of job markets, and also probably the more informal dimensions of networking. And I think those are really, you know, sincere, and obviously those are direct experiences that our students are having. I think the counter to this, though, is, and I think it's important to bear in mind, I mean, we're going through a wholesale transformation within this country, all of us, you know, international students and Canadians, and it's really whole of society in all dimensions, you know, in the first instance, kind of health and well-being, but thinking about recovery, those social and economic dimensions. Within this last year, one of the encouraging things that we saw is we were increasingly wanting to see more opportunities for international students and thinking about those pathways to postgraduate work opportunities and the labor market and future pathways to permanent residency. The 700 and some chapters of the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, and I know this isn't something that's very well known, but each of those individual chapters had in fact passed a resolution about a year ago recognizing the importance and the value of international students. And I know that that's at the level of a symbolic statement, but the fact that you had acknowledgement within each of those local communities, 700 and some of them across Canada, that this was something that needed, you know, specific attention and focus, and that they were keen to create those pathways, I think there's an interesting space to, you know, explore how we shape that recovery and really look to kind of embed our international students in that recovery process. Because I agree that there are some elements of significant disconnect, but I do see an opportunity, but also have to acknowledge that, you know, we have seen that challenging rhetoric, and we have seen that much more insular thinking in different communities. And I think, you know, we need to work with employers in really trying to shape those pathways as part of that recovery, not as an add-on or an afterthought, but as an intrinsic part of, you know, our country's recovery. Because I know we celebrate the positive aspects of that engagement and that mobility of students who come to learn and those pathways. And as we think about Canada's own, you know, future and growth and demographic challenges, you know, 20 to 50 years out, I think it's incumbent upon all of us to think very creatively at this time, at this difficult time, about how we bring those disconnected pieces together in a meaningful way and in a sustainable way. Thanks.
Larissa, you're moving the conversation in exactly the direction I was hoping. So, Chris, Nathaniel, anything you want to add in terms of the impacts on post-graduation pathways, or have we covered it?
No, I think Larissa has covered it in quite a bit of detail.
Okay, well, the reason I'm so pleased by this is that what I wanted to ask about next is for Chris and for Nathaniel. What did you put in place for the fall? Nathaniel's already mentioned you put in place lots of effort in terms of arrival of the 500 students. I hope that you managed to feed them. Universities and colleges in the United States are having a terrible time feeding students in quarantine. So I hope you were more successful. And you've talked about making a distinction between courses that could be online and courses that they had to show up for. Is there anything else that colleges and then Chris universities have done to prepare for the fall and for what turns out to be a very uncertain course of the pandemic? Nathaniel?
Yeah, as I mentioned, we had a very detailed arrival protocol where we did assist students with accommodations that needed it, that required assistance with meals throughout the day, or even just someone to talk to. I've got four staff who are just sitting here on the phones, calling students that are still in quarantine, that were in quarantine, and just, you know, just being an ear just to let them know that you can get through it. Like, You've come this far, we're here for you. Is there anything that we can drop off for you at your quarantine location? Anything, you know, toiletries even sometimes that some, you know, we've all traveled where you've forgotten something. Is there something we can do? We've got some great partners in the community that have accommodations available that are looking after some of those students after hours. Checking in with them on their mental health, on their physical well-being, that was right from our president on down, was that this was paramount before anything else. Let's take care of these students who are coming in this month. And then moving forward, as I mentioned, we're stick handling these new requirements from the senior levels of government, is the college is going to provide those 14-day accommodations for free to those students. It's something that they don't have to worry about when they come later this fall or into 2021. So we're expanding our traditional soft landing, we call it, you know, protocol or mandate to those 14 days. We have a doctor on call that will be visiting these quarantine locations, doing some mandatory testing, talking to them. We've partnered with CMHA, making sure that students have a professional that they can speak to during these times. So that's one thing. The other thing is too, and I notice our friends from the New Canadian Center for Excellence are on the call as well, is offering workshops to all international students, whether they're at home or they're here in Canada, throughout the semester this fall, understanding, you know, how to cope with anxiety during this distance learning phase, or how to prepare that when they do eventually come to Canada, perhaps giving them some of that knowledge so that it's as smooth transition as they could expect, with some tools, some practical tools that will make that that move to Canada, hopefully here in the near future, as smooth as possible. So those are a few things outside of the classroom that I know my office has looked after and we've put into place that we typically don't have to worry about in a pre-COVID environment.
Chris, thank you.
Now, Nathaniel covered, I think, a lot of the elements that I think are really common in the higher education sector, not only in Ontario, but across the country. At our institution, I think some of the, maybe the two main elements would be trying to be able to pivot to deliver the same type of services that we normally would, but in a remote environment. So for example, booking an appointment with the career advisor. We know at the institution that career development and experiential learning opportunities are really well, you know, the uptake for those services is significant by our international student population. So being able to continue those type of services, I think, is essential, and being able to ensure that they can still continue with their plan, be it to complete the degree and to potentially gain an experience here in Canada as well. On top of the financial supports, you know, that we provided to be able to offset some of the challenges that they face there, that was some of the main elements to it. But, you know, I do think it's important that I think institutions still struggle being able to provide the support which international students really are seeking, and that primarily is on the immigration and settlement piece. There still is a significant, I think, gap between the role of an institution and the role of, you know, settlement agencies and those community partnerships. Because I think what COVID has taught us is it's pointed out weaknesses in our systems. It's pointed out weaknesses in tracking where our students are at the beginning of the pandemic. It's pointed out weaknesses in regards to the individual or group issues in which they face. And so I do think we need, as an institution, to maybe step back and have a better acknowledgement of the unique needs that these groups have, and maybe come up with a strategy on how to be able to start filling those gaps as we move forward. Mostly, if I go back to some of the strategic documents from the federal government about the idea of the rationale about why we want international students on our campus, you know, and why we want them to contribute to society and to drive us forward. To get out of this current environment, we're going to need innovation, and innovation is going to come through international students that are contributing back to our economy and societies as well.
Okay, you guys are just great. That's perfect, Chris, because I want to ask on Keith, when I listen to the issues that you raise for internationals, that you mentioned for international students, and I listen to Larissa, and then I hear from Nathaniel and Chris, I see a disconnect. Now, Chris is getting to that disconnect, because on Keith, you do want the universities and the colleges to do more locally on their campuses, but you also want much wider policy changes. Is that a fair comment? How are we going to get there? Which stakeholders should be involved? Chris has sort of danced towards that discussion, and so has Nathaniel, by mentioning the settlement agencies that provide services for mostly permanent residents. in terms of language training, job training, orientation to the job market, some general information stuff. But Ankit, who should, yes, I'm going to get Nathaniel, we'll let Ankit, and then you. So Ankit, who should be involved other than the universities and colleges?
I think, Valerie, you hit one of the biggest, the at the very core of this entire discussion is this question, who should be involved? And while the question is about who should be involved in giving these services, we have to ask the question of who should be involved in making these decisions. And in my experience, so we've been having conversations with CFS member locals. UWinsor is one of them. UWSA is one of our member locals. And we've been involved in these conversations. And the biggest common theme we've seen being noticed is that most universities in our country have excluded, specifically excluded students from the decision-making bodies for the pandemic. I think the question to ask, not just my fellow panelists, but also to everybody on this call is, whichever educational institution you are on, are there permanent student seats on your board of governors? And were those seats involved in the subcommittees or the committees that helped make the primary decisions for this entire pandemic and its response? Were students consulted in the decision-making processes? Because for the most part, the answer has been no. And it's not like the students aren't asking to be included in these discussions, right? But the places and the processes through which we try to be included haven't accepted our perspectives. And then we end up in panels like these where we come to realize that there's a disconnect. And so the disconnect happens at the decision-making bodies. We haven't been included and it's shown in the response. But that said, you're absolutely right to state that locally, community-based, in the city, in the county, in the province, in the whole country, these are all the levels at which the response needs to be coordinated. International students are currently facing the brunt of the housing crisis in Canada, right? Here in Peterborough, we have less than 1% as a vacancy rate, and we get scammed. We hear scamming stories regularly about how more students are just stuffed in rooms like sardines. And it's we know that fire safety laws are pretty strict in Ontario and landlords are able to get away with it by taking advantage of international students that got here last month, right? It's hard for us to learn the entire constitution in a month and the landlords aren't helping. So how is that happening, right? What measures is the city putting in? But also, is the province helping us gain access to education and funding so that we can continue staying here and including us in all those discussions? Is the country including us in the discussions of immigration, right? I was actually looking at the Prime Minister's Youth Council. And if you are not a permanent resident or a protected person, if not a citizen, you can't be on it, which means that any person with a temporary stay permit just can't be on the Prime Minister's Youth Council, even though their decisions and they're consulted for things that do impact us. I would rather leave you with a question than an answer, but I think this is the question that's worth asking.
It's a very serious question because it goes to the nature of citizenship. But let me ask Nathaniel. You put your hand up, Nathaniel. What would you like to add?
And it was more of a very focused response to your comment about who should be involved in those discussions. And there is a pilot project that was rolled out right before COVID hit with the Ontario government, that they're examining the provincial nominee process. And Chatham-Kent, where a community where we do have a campus, was one of the three communities where that pilot has been rolled out, where the ministry has earmarked a numerical value of the province's nominations for this year to these three communities,
right.
And they've set up a system where international students or foreign nationals are able to match with a job that is in need that traditionally is not on that sort of PR scorecard. And it's kind of more of a real life getting people to work in jobs that are underserved in community, like a community like Chatham-Kent. So there have been applicants that are international students. There have been individuals outside of Canada that are going through the process right now. So it'll be interesting to see how this two-year project rolls out and if it's positive. I think it's one of those kind of small steps forward to closing that gap between jobs that are in demand and international students or immigrants being connected with those and having a clear pathway to permanent residency and becoming a contributing member of our society. So that was just kind of, when you mentioned that came to mind, but we maybe want to be talking about what Ankiel had brought up.
No. Well, actually, it's a good example, Nathaniel, because it is on a very small scale and fairly short term to begin with, an attempt to coordinate across those many different decision-making bodies that Anki talked about, because it goes from the federal to the provincial to the municipal level and then brings in local community colleges and universities. So I would like to see somebody study it and see how it's actually working so we understood that. But we are running out of time for all of you to speak, and I have one last question I want to bring up. In this very rapidly changing policy environment that you've all talked about, I spent the first 6 months of this year in New York City. So if you think things were moving rapidly here, I'm sorry. You haven't lived until you live in the United States right now to know what change is. We used to watch the Canadian news at night so that there was calm. And this was March, April, May when things were pretty interesting here. But in this rapidly changing policy environment, can you each give me one thing that universities, colleges, other stakeholders could do that would facilitate international students' resilience at the current moment, especially for those who come, the 70% who come, hoping to stay? What is one thing? And I'm going to start with you, Larissa.
Oh, sure. I was going to say, give me a minute to think about it, because as I've been listening to this conversation and reflecting, I wanted to take a few minutes. But that's a loaded question. What Ankit just shared, I think creating the space to elevate the voices of international students and to put them at the center of all of this, such that their own voices can inform how we chart this path forward, I think is really important. It's something that we as an organization have been looking at. I mean, we're a membership-based organization and our institutions of learning are our members. We've also been feeling that desire, you know, to really, really connect. It's a slippery slope. I think we all, with good intention, are trying to provide those supports, and we certainly create spaces to seek input. But from a systemic standpoint, I don't think we figured that piece out. And I think that's a really critical one, because in the absence of that, I think we're never fully going to realize, you know, the benefits both for those students, perhaps those hoped for future Canadians, but also for the international education sector in Canada and all the richness that comes from international students' engagement.
Thank you. And Chris?
Thanks, Valerie. So I think in regards to this space, I would focus on maybe one area, and that's outside of our traditional delivery of educational services. And, you know, recognizing that resilience is the ability to recover and adjust from misfortune and change, I think we have to be able to support and stand up our international students more when it comes to their own career development and the pathway for that, mostly in the COVID world. You know, recognizing that future employability is the big driver, adopting a career development framework with that intentional career planning. So international students can respond to, in this case, the pandemic, given that it's fluid and dynamic and a lifelong process. So I think institutions of higher education can help by, you know, teaching the ability for doing assessment and exploration and skills development and all those elements, not only within the classroom, but also the co-curricular and extracurricular space. I think that's where institutions can really help. And that means helping international students identify and clarify their goals and empowering them to thrive. Because I know that resiliency is there, but it may need to be supported more to build that resilient mindset to make sure that they are successful and do contribute back.
Okay. Nathaniel, one thing.
One thing I would agree with both Larissa and Chris, but to maybe mention something different, a little bit off of what Chris said, was I think as an institution, we were forced out of our comfort zone, and I think that was a really great thing to happen. And we
can speak for yourself.
Pardon me?
Speak for yourself as one of the faculty members.
So I think it has allowed us to look at how we do education and how we provide student services differently. And we don't always have to say, well, you know, and I mentioned at the beginning of this, we're applied education. It's got to be hands-on. Well, you know, can we expand how we do that? And we've gone through it, knock on wood, somewhat with success these last few months. And so I hope that innovative spirit continues on through the next few years and as we go into this post-COVID world. That's one thing I hope that we take away from this and how our international students will be able to reap that benefit from an institution that thinks outside the box.
So Ankit, I'm going to give you one last word, 2 minutes. What is the one thing that you would like all these people to go away thinking should be done? One thing and concrete.
I'll ensure that it's less than 2 minutes. So I think I'm going to leave everybody with some rhetoric. I don't think international students should be treated the way we are. We should be treated the way you want us to be. And you want us to be permanent residents and taxpaying citizens of this country. Treat us that way. And to every individual listening to this, let's participate in the democracy to make sure it's actually ours. Let's stay in touch with our representatives at all levels of government and administration to ensure that the things that are best for us and in our interest are actually getting done instead of reacting afterwards.
Okay. Well, I want to thank all the panelists. There are lots of questions in the chat box. So let me take a moment to just have a quick look at them and see what people have asked about. I have to roll up here. So one of the first questions that's asked is, what's the percentage of international students? This is for Chris and for Nathaniel. You may know Ankit, but internationally, so chime in. What's the percentage of international students that are currently studying remotely from their home countries? Of the international students still enrolled, what percentage are not in Canada and studying remotely? Chris, have you got any ideas?
Well, Valerie, I saw that question come through in the chat, and I was hoping that you weren't going to get to it. And the reason
I always go up to the top.
Yeah, that's good. And the reason being is I think institutions in this online environment have difficulty knowing where the students are in general. So I really, as an institution, we do not have a very good handle on that. Anecdotal evidence, you know, suggests we can see where some students are logging into, but that is a challenge, and trying to figure out how to support them remotely is difficulty.
Okay. Nathaniel, do you know better?
Was the question about their studying?
What percentage of your international students are abroad, studying online?
About 20%.
So 80% are here,
yeah,
in Canada. Wow. Wow.
Most of those students, though, I would imagine, I don't know the percentage of that 80% that would be outside of Windsor.
Okay.
Do know that, yeah, but, yeah.
Okay. Keith, does CFS or have any idea how many of the international students enrolled at Canadian universities are now studying abroad?
No, we don't. I don't have a national number, but I can share the data from Trent. Among undergraduate statistics, we're looking at a range of 16 to 22%. It seems as though that there's a lot more people logging in from international servers, but we're just going to point that towards the, you know, heightened use of VPNs these days. So there might, it's actually being an issue in tracking that data. But here at Trent, we're looking at 16 to 22%.
Okay. Yeah. And Larissa, have you got any idea from any of the information you've been able to collect?
It really is. Thanks, Valerie. It really is a range. And you know, to Chris's point, I mean, it's more anecdotal than scientific, but our sense from a host of institutions across the country, and it also comes down to just what the profile of their international student population looks like as a, you know, as a proportion of the broader student population. It's in that range of kind of 10 to 30%. Okay. You know, we're hearing that across institutions, but by no means a scientific number.
So, in the chat, someone has noted that the majority of new students are studying abroad at least one of the colleges. And so that 80% or 70 to 80% who are here in Canada would be students in the second, third, continuing students. It's exactly. The new students, which I think is quite interesting. Someone asks about going to Italy. I'm not going to raise that question here. I don't think any of us are immigration experts in terms of those regulations. If you do have a question about travel, you should check out the IRCC and CBSA websites. If the pandemic continues longer than December, someone asks, do you think international students will still have to fulfill the 50% requirement for subjects to be completed inside Canada? Now, this is total speculation. I know none of you knows, but is anybody willing to hazard a guess? Because you're more informed than the rest of us. Who would like to hazard a guess? Larissa?
Sure, happy to jump in. And just to be very clear, I do not speak on behalf of IRCC, nor do I have that crystal ball. I think we've been encouraged by the kind of responsiveness and nimbleness that we have seen from IRCC since the beginning of the pandemic, you know, and incrementally we've seen those changes, you know, every month, every few weeks. So I think, you know, as the timeline extends in terms of the pandemic for Canada, for the rest of the globe, I anticipate, and I think I would, you know, cautiously but optimistically think that we would continue to see that nimbleness. I know for some of you who may have patched in recently to kind of a globe conversation that was hosted with Rita Tritcher a few weeks ago, we have those in the business sector like John Stackhouse from RBC who were saying, you know what, open it up. And even our colleague from Athabasca, the president talking about, you know, we should have students studying from online for their entire program. Now, that doesn't exist within the current Canadian framework, but I think there's some interesting conversations happening in the country. And a lot of out-of-the-box thinking that we haven't seen for some time.
Okay. That's. Anybody else want to add anything to that? It's total speculation. Ankit?
Sure. I think...
No, here's my question.
Yeah.
Larissa mentions the nimbleness, the flexibility, and I think that's a fair comment. And these are unprecedented times. You know, governments rolling out programs, you know, in 3 weeks' notice is just unheard of. What does that shifting in policy environment, though, and the fairly short timelines for policy changes do to international students? That's what I'm asking about.
I think the government needs to sit down and really think about international students in one session. Because this nimbleness is a great word, but what it's essentially done is that it's just adding certainty. A lot of decisions are made, not just by administrations, but also by individuals on some sense of certainty in some temporal frame. And that has entirely been eradicated. Now we're just like, I'm going to do this. If this happens, I'm going to do that. If that happens, but none of the above might actually happen. Right.
Okay. So that's fair.
I think for policy standpoint, maybe it might be important to consider the language and discuss, instead of location, the institution where it's happening. If you're studying at a college, a recognized college or university within from Canada, even if you're doing it abroad, perhaps there is scope for you to come into the country.
Okay. Well, that brings me to my next question. Someone has asked, do you need an international student permit in order to take online courses? Nathaniel, can you clarify that?
Do you need a study permit to begin online?
To study for online course, to take an online course.
No, you wouldn't need it to take an online course if you wanted to take an isolated online course. If your goal of taking that course or courses was to lead to permanent postgraduate work permit, you would have to have applied for a visa before September 15th, I think are the current rules of as of today. And received an AIP or approval in principle. And then you would have received credit for this term online in your home country with that approval from IRCC. I apologize if I got that wrong.
You got it right. If you wanted a degree or a diploma from a Canadian university or college, you need to apply for an international student study permit.
But we have courses.
If you just want to take a single course or one or two courses and you're not interested in a degree or diploma, as long as you pay the tuition, you're good to go. So someone has asked here, from outside the university or the college, how do organizations reach international students? There are no email lists, there are no, cell phone lists. How can organizations operating outside universities and colleges find out who's an international student and how to contact them? Is this even possible?
If I was an outside organization, I would approach your community or the closest community's university or college. A lot of us are running around with startup, but we're always happy to meet with an organization that may have a solution and think of something that maybe we've missed in the busyness, and they may have a proposal for us to consider. And it's up to those individual institutions to bring that organization on campus and help leverage those connections.
And Chris, what do you think? If organizations contacted, I'm not going to suggest they contact you, but if they contacted the University of Windsor, would they be able, do you think, to build a collaboration that would give them access to that information?
Yeah, Valerie, I think what Nathaniel alluded to is absolutely correct. I think, institutions of higher education, colleges, universities, we play a key role in supporting, not only the academic success, but in this case, the settlement success of international students. So I would be hoping that external agencies would be looking to partner with educational institutions, mostly because for, I think, academic success to be true, it needs to be that not only do they complete a degree, do they have a great experience, but they can transition into the workforce. If we look at how we measure quality of education here in Ontario, we're looking at employability 6 months, 2 years. We should be doing the exact same thing for international students and looking about where is the skills gap that they may have that we should be looking to fill? How can we partner with external agencies to help fill that as well? And how can we think of that population holistically versus just someone who's coming in for a class and then leaving?
Okay. So, Chris, to follow up on that, Ankit, what would you like to add?
Yeah, if you are a community organization that's hoping to get access to international students, I mean, I suppose universities and colleges are bound by FIPA to not share any personally identifiable information. But what you can do is actually contact the institution to set up either a co-op, an internship, or at least at Trent, we have something called community-based research project where somebody can work somewhere with a specific topic and get credit for it, get money for it, or both.
Okay. So someone has asked, which communities, let me rephrase this. They begin by saying that international students are largely seen as stakeholders of their educational institutions. And you have all emphasized that they are in fact part of broader communities. And this person says, well, can you point to any specific examples where the broader community beyond the universities and colleges is actually engaging in substantive ways to support international students and community development and community connections? What are some examples? Nathaniel has mentioned the pilot for the municipal nominee program. Are there any other examples that anybody can identify where there is this engagement with international students beyond the universities and colleges?
Anybody? Maybe Valerie, maybe I can hop in, maybe provide, and maybe I'll ask Larissa to comment on this as well. Maybe to look on our East Coast partners and institutions where the educational systems have partnered with government to come up with comprehensive strategies when it comes to immigration to offset a declining local population. I do believe, you know, the kind of EduNova, that those kind of spaces become the beginning of models that other provinces should be looking at adopting. And that also requires, you know, buy-in from all levels. And that's really what's happening out on the East Coast. There is the commitment on the municipalities, the provincial, and also the federal jurisdictions on top of institutions to come together with a comprehensive solution. They identify what the labor market needs, you know, and is supportive of that. To me, that I think is the strongest example that I could think of off the top of my head. But maybe Larissa, you might know more from other member institutions of CBIE.
Thanks, Chris. And I mean, I concur. It's one of the examples that came to mind is exactly the cooperative of EduNova. For those that you might not be familiar, as Chris mentioned, I mean, it basically groups together not only education institutions, and so that could be at the school board level, touching on kind of late high school years, touches certainly on the post-secondary space, engages, you know, the labor market and employers through the different chambers and other actors, and also provincial and federal and municipal governments in an interesting constellation. So there's a core group, which is the institutions themselves, but it's really about the collaborative effort. And so several years ago, they had worked together to scope out what is now kind of recognized as the Nova Scotia Study and Stay Program. So initially a pilot, but something that has been scaled up over time, where they're literally looking to, in a piloted fashion, not only resource, but from an infrastructure standpoint, build an interesting pathway to permanent residency within Nova Scotia. And there are some really meaningful kind of success stories that have come out of these first few years of experience. The one other example that comes to mind, and it's just one among probably a number that I'm certainly have been made aware of as I've reached out and engaged with our institutions is, for example, a lot of the collaboration that you see in the community in Hamilton between Mohawk College, involving McMaster University, involving the municipality, and many other community support programs to really create what I would describe as kind of a wraparound of support, you know, a whole network of support systems around those international students. So concrete examples, you know, working with the municipality to, you know, kind of match those international students as they're coming into communities with other community peers, getting them access to library cards, taking them through the community and helping them navigate everything from, you know, using public transportation to finding their way within a community. So basic, you know, life skills and access to, you know, all kinds of layers of community support, settlement, you know, employment, et cetera. And I think that's a really vivid example. I know there are many others in other jurisdictions, but it's another one that comes to mind.
That's great, Larissa. It's, now, before I finish, Ankit, Nathaniel, you have exactly 1 minute each. Is there anything you want to add?
Nate's shaking his head. Okay. Yeah, I think so.
Take my minute then.
Happily. here at Trent, much of the things that Larissa mentioned, like helping international students actually learn the way Canada works, we've actually had we've been able to get our international office to do all of those things. Organize international students, get us and take us on the bus, teach us, you know, how to use the bus because it's very different. Getting a bank account, getting a phone, a SIM card, what are your laws, what are your immigration laws, how to be aware of them, what about housing, are you living on or off campus? All of this is actually done by Trent's international office. Partially in the orientation week, and then what we call continued transition, which is just programming that happens all through fall that international students come to. And it matures as you go on. So in early fall, you'll see it being a more basic skills-based, building a community and getting used to Canada. Whereas by the time you get to March, April, the sessions are more like the pathways to permanent residency, how do you get a post-graduation work permit, how do you apply for jobs, careers, so on and so forth? What do upper year courses look like? How do you get into co-op, so on and so forth? So that's all that's done by the international office alone. Okay. Now, I organize with the Trent International Students Association, which does the student community building part of it. So we're one of the bigger levy groups at Trent, and every person at Trent pays into our levy. And we work towards building a structure and connections between international students and Peterborough, between domestic students on our campus, because we often find, and everybody here who's interactive with international students knows, that we tend to clump up in small groups, right? And the purpose that we serve here is to allow those clumped, communities to really flourish, but also connect them to the Peterborough community and the domestic students here, so that, you know, it doesn't breed that divide that tends to lead to conflict. So that's what the International Student Association does. And finally, I've mentioned this before, I'm gonna mention this again. The task that we've taken on is, we don't have a vote, yes, but to take part in democratic processes, voting is only one part. We've set up direct lines with the mayor of Peterborough, where TISA actually meets with the mayor to talk about the needs of international students fairly regularly. So let's build that.
I want to thank the four panelists who have at breakneck galloping speed answered as many questions as possible. You've just been terrific, and I am also very pleased to see the serious questions about democratic participation and the nature of citizenship and who's entitled to it, which underlie many of the comments all of the panelists have made. There is a small evaluation, which we ask that you fill in. This is the first time we've done one of these webinars online, so we really need to know what worked and what didn't work. I have some opinions already, of course. If you could fill that in and send it in. But before you do that, could you please join me in letting the panelists know that they have done simply a great job. Thank you very much, the four of you, and I hope it was also useful for you. So don't go anywhere till you fill in this evaluation. And in particular, in here, there are some questions about what would you like to learn about in future panels. So I think we got lots of ideas from particularly the last half of the discussion. So thank you very much. I really, really appreciate it. I will clap by myself. Thank you. And please fill in the form. This is my biggest responsibility, is to get you to fill in the form.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much, Valerie. It's been great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Valerie.
You were wonderful. Thank you. Talk soon, Chris. And Nathaniel, we will talk again. Ankit, we will talk again. And Larissa as well. Take care.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
You'll hear more.
It's time to go back being a student. See everybody in my class.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
I know all these.